This is Audible.
Blood of Ajax by Robbie McNiven, read by John Banks. Chapter 1. To the Gorgon. Castor. The Fulminata had come to Shebat Alpha, and none could stand before them. Castor, chaplain of the Dioscuri, roared. It was an expression of pure rage, fueled by piety and stoked by righteous hatred. The noise, amplified by his vox vocalizer, made the bellows and grunts of the greenskins surrounding him sound pitiable by comparison. Salve Imperator shattered an orc's skull. It then snapped the neck of a second, hurling the beast back into its kindred. Energy crackled around the skull-topped Crozius Arcanum, blackened blood evaporating from it with every searing strike of the power mace. Bones cracked, and flesh was pulverized. The towering Primaris chaplain was a whirlwind of furious judgment, his leather cassock and vestments snapping around him, his pitch-black power armor splattered with a patina of alien viscera. He had moved too far ahead. He was cut off. The realization made him smile. An orc attempted to headbutt him. It rammed itself impotently against the stylized ribcage that encased his breastplate. Castor snatched the beast by the throat with his free hand, hauling it from its feet so that its piggy eyes were level with the deep ruby lenses of his skull helm. The beast bellowed at him, spittle spraying from its maw, but the chaplain silenced it with a headbutt of his own, bone cracking and tusks snapping as he caved in the alien's face. He dropped the orc, his armor registering the strikes of crude cleavers and fists from all sides. None penetrated. He spun in a tight arc, vestment scrolls whipping around him, and cleared a semicircle of space with a single swing of Salve Imperator.
"See how easily the alien falls before the weaponry of the righteous," the chaplain boomed. "Praise the Emperor for giving us this chance to enact his will."
His slaughterous euphoria was interrupted by the familiar, battering thunder of boltfire. Blood and sinew burst around him as a hail of mass reactive bolts shredded the mob attacking him, their remains splattering his armor. Already, the runtier greenskins at the rear of the melee had turned tail and were fleeing back up the street, perhaps unwilling to engage something that could bellow louder than one of their war bosses. Castor let them go, the battle fury draining abruptly from his genhanced body.
"Too far again, Salve," said Captain Demeter.
The commander of the Fulminata was clad in his gravis plate, the proud heraldry of the Ultramarines befouled by blood and grime. Behind him was Intercessor Squad Nerva and ancient Mars Skyrus, who bore the lightning standard of Fulminata. Its blue and white silk rippled in the smoke shrouding the embattled street, the weak sunlight glinting from the wings of the golden bolt and aquila that tipped its crosspiece.
"The Xenos exist to be purged," Castor responded, "and I exist to perform that purging."
The deafening report of a battle cannon interrupted Demeter before he could respond, the shell shrieking over the heads of the Primaris. It detonated further up the street in a great storm of broken masonry and orc remains. Castor turned to survey the Imperial forces behind the Ultramarines, a squadron of Voitican Lehman Russ battle tanks grinding forwards in single file, supported by a platoon of Astra Militarum infantry from the same world. They paused, crouched on the pavement, as they stared up in undisguised awe at the Primaris who had broken the orc mob. Castor raised Salve Imperator, the Crozius still wreathed with lightning.
"See how the beasts run, soldiers of the throne," he said, his voice booming over the growl of engines and rattle of nearby gunfire. "This is our city, the Emperor's city, and we will reclaim it one step at a time. Press on, Crush these alien remains beneath your boots and the treads of your mighty tanks. The Emperor protects.
The advance continued.
Watch the Manufactorum colonnades to the right, Demeter ordered over the Vox, highlighting a series of towering industrial pillars on the shared tactical display. The huge rockcrete structures had once been testimony to Shabbat's productivity, but now lay cast down in rubble and ruin, a metaphor for the city's fall. It had been great once, the foremost manufactorum of Ikara IX's adamantium belt, a refinery for the vast deposits of ore mined in the tombstones, the mountain range within whose barren flanks the city nestled. 4 millennia of industry had created a sprawling hive of smokestacks and smelter scrapes, surrounded by a thicket of prefabricated habitation blocks, and a further sprawl of slums and shack dwellings. Then the green menace had come to the Ikara system, and Shabbat's productivity had ended. Castor Blink acknowledged Demeter's directive via the visor display, and drew his Absolver bolt pistol. Its heavy-caliber rounds made a mockery of even the tough hides and thick bones of the orcs, each detonating shell bursting apart chests and skulls in gouts of blood and pulverized organs. He forced himself to check his pace so he didn't begin to outdistance his battle brothers once more.
With the support of the Astra Militarum, we've already succeeded in pushing the greenskins back, Demeter continued. The Xenos currently fester in a refinery square overlooked by the industrial plant's ruins.
The map of Shabbat overlaid on Castor's visor display showed that they were less than a mile from the day's primary objective, the Excelsior Arch. It had been more than a Terran year since war had engulfed Shabbat. For a while, when the port city of Melu burned and the greenskin forces had reached the outskirts of Ikara IX's capital city, Croton, it had seemed as though the planet would fall to the alien invasion. Then the Fulminata, a Primaris demi-company of the Ultramarines chapter, had been dispatched, alongside the primary Imperial Navy subsector battle fleet, 3 Astra Militarum army groups, and a convoy of Imperial Knights from House Dufresne. Within 5 days, Castor and his brothers had driven the Xenos from the capital's outskirts, then followed up by breaking the greenskin siege lines encircling Mercoro. 2 weeks ago, the Brotherhood had arrived outside Shabbat. The Astra Militarum's 3rd Army, commanded by Field Marshal Stefan Kloss, had secured the slum sprawl and established 3 beachheads into the city proper. Now the drive to the Gorgon was underway.
"Maintain fire protocols," Demeter said over the Vox,
his voice as calm and measured as it was during the company's firing rites on board the Spear of Macrag. Intercessor Squad Nerva had secured the main thoroughfare leading into the square, laying down bolt rifle fire as the orcs charged them from all 4 corners. The open space allowed the trio of Voitican battle tanks to spread out, their heavy bolters and battle cannons hammering shells point blank into the oncoming mobs.
"See how the Emperor's wrath cuts them down!"
Castor bellowed to the Astra Militarum infantry squads advancing out between their tanks, adding their las fire to the barrage.
"Keep firing! Not a single greenskin is to leave this place alive!"
"Castor,"
Demeter said, his tone full of warning. The chaplain had begun to advance again.
"They will not stand, brother captain,"
he said.
"And you will not present them with an easy target," the captain responded.
Return fire broke out from the ruins around the square's edges, more mobs of greenskins armed with crude sidearms flocking to join the battle spreading through the refineries. Their shooting was worse than inaccurate, but there was enough of it for Castor to take 2 hits to his breastplate and another to his left greave in quick succession.
"Lieutenant, bring your weaponry to bear on the refineries,"
Demeter said. The order routed to the commander of the Voitican armor. A clipped affirmation coincided with the whine of turret hydraulics as the battle tanks switched targets. They never got a chance to fire. The enhanced aural units of Castor's armor detected a high-pitched whistle, growing rapidly louder.
"Incoming!"
Sergeant Nerva was the first to shout the warning, issuing it over his external vocalizer for the benefit of the guard infantry. The first shell hit the space between the leftmost and centermost of the three Lehman Ross battle tanks. The Voitican infantry squad there simply vanished in a hail of metal and rubble that battered the sides of their tanks, spattering the vehicles with tattered human remains. Another five shells struck the square within 3 seconds of the first. Fire blossomed, the detonations ripping indiscriminately into greenskins and imperial soldiers alike. One hit the ground barely a dozen yards to Castor's right. He felt his auto-stabilizers lock as the blast wave struck, accompanied by a storm of rubble and dirt. His armor blared with alarms, the auto-sensors indicating shrapnel damage to his right pauldron and knee joint. When the smoke settled, however, he stood unmoved, his crozier shining bright with destructive energies amidst the haze.
"Xenos artillery," Demeter voxed, "coming from across the river. I'm routing the coordinates to Xerxes, but it will be at least 20 minutes before the bombardment cannon is locked."
"Priscor and Quintilius have been hit," Sergeant Nerva added. "If we stay here, we die. We either go back or we go into them."
"Into them, then!"
Castor snarled, feeling his battle fury surging to life once more.
"As the brother chaplain says,"
Demeter responded calmly, as the air filled with the shriek of more incoming shells.
"Primaris, advance!"
Polixis.
"Medike!"
Polixis was already moving up along the street's left-hand pavement when he heard the scream. Ahead, he could see a platoon of Numerian Imperial Guardsmen caught in a barrage of crudely aimed orc firepower coming from a bombed-out residential block. He watched as the Numerian's colonel went down. Polixis kept to the side of the street, instinctively knowing that it was unlikely any of the orc shots would be coming his way when there were so many targets out of cover ahead of him. In just a few seconds, the Numerians had taken a slew of casualties. He saw the platoon's medic, caught sprinting towards the fallen colonel, collapse in a burst of blood as he in turn was hit in the side of the head.
"Medike!"
came the scream again. Polixis cursed. He considered carrying on through the haulage workyards to his left to link back up with the squad Valorius. But with the Numerian colonel down, their entire advance was stalling, and the wider spearhead couldn't afford that. Against his better judgment, Polixis cursed and broke from cover. He ran from the street's edge and crossed to the downed colonel, using his bulk to shield the man. Shots came cracking his way, but he was too busy assessing the Numerian's injury to even notice. The man had taken a hit to the leg, probably an artery shot. Polixis spent precious moments slicing away his blood-drenched fatigues, trying to decide how to deal with the wound. His own equipment was far superior to anything carried by the guard, but he had forgotten just how incredibly fragile humans were. It was only at times such as these, kneeling over the wounded soldier, that he properly appreciated the gulf between the Imperium's fighting forces. Arterial spray painted Polixus's white gauntlets red. The Primaris apothecary let out a slow breath as he tied off the torn femoral artery, applying a coating of counterseptic powder to the bloody gash in the colonel's thigh. The Numerian screamed.
"I have nothing for your pain," Polixis said gruffly. "Everything that will fortify my brothers would kill your kind."
Polixis bound the wound tightly with a bandage pad taken from the man's supplies and looked across at the Numerian platoon's corpsman. He was kneeling on the pavement, hands and forearms as red and soaking as the Space Marines. His expression was an all-too-familiar rictus of concentration as he fought to tourniquet a leg torn almost in half by an orc slug round. More hard rounds cracked past, one grazing Polixis's shoulder. Numerian infantry were supporting a combat team from Intercessor Squad Valorius as they secured the haulage workyards of the refinery district, a slow, grinding battle that had been going on since dawn. It had put their sector of the assault behind schedule. Polixis had been drawn from the main spearhead by two injuries to Valorius, brothers Vespasia and Gallus. Neither were fatal, but the same could not be said of the wounds the Numerians were sustaining. The apothecary's heads-up tactical display lit with new information. The spearhead of the Primaris assault, driving directly for the Excelsior Arch, had suffered 3 casualties. The logs scrolling past identified heavy shelling, and the gun's thumping reports were audible from where he stood. He blink-clicked the company command channel.
"This is Helix. Do you have need of me, Captain?"
"If not now, then we will soon, Brother Apothecary," crackled Demeter's voice, overlaid by the crash of detonations. "Redeploy to our coordinates with all haste."
Polixis sent an affirmation and moved to the side of the guard corpsman struggling nearby. He bent down and grasped the bloody limb in one hand, yanking the tourniquet into place with the other. The wounded man wailed, slick with sweat, his face a wretched mask. He had the white eyes of a beast in pain, stripped of the intelligence and dignity of the human race. It was difficult to resist an impulsive sense of disgust at such a display. "He is only a man," Polixis found himself thinking. Now was no time to consider the contrast between the guardsman's desperate, agonized expression and his own stark, white battleplate and helm. He wondered whether the man's terror was magnified by his presence. It would not surprise him.
"I must go now," he said to the corpsman,
who was looking at him with wide eyes.
"Check to make sure it's tight enough, and tie off the popliteal. As far as I can judge your kind, the colonel is stable, but you must get him to cover. Remember your training, and you will save lives here today."
The man visibly struggled to find a response, staring at the giant, white-armored warrior. But Polixis was already moving off, breaking into a run as he left the humans behind and headed south. He checked the visor display again as he went. One of the 3 wounded sigils, Orvidos, had flashed from yellow to red. He was flatlining rapidly, the vitae signs on Polixis's diagnostic helm fading. The apothecary picked up speed, servos whirring, boots pounding debris-strewn streets, as he used the burst map uploaded to the shared TAC display to navigate along the rear of the ground taken in the morning's assault. The orcs had been driven from their positions across the city, yielding 4 miles in barely an hour and a half. The Gorgon was almost within touching distance. Polixis's map turned him westwards, back onto the leading edge of the assault. Staying behind the immediate front line would take too long. He would have to skirt through it. Passing a trail of injured Astra Militarum troopers and stretcher-bearers in the pelts of the Tamaran scalp-takers, he headed down a side street, away from a gunfight that appeared to have broken out in the smelter workyard of a refinery Primus. The tribal warriors cringed back at the Space Marines passing, averting their eyes from a being Polixis knew they likely deified. He barely even acknowledged their presence, instead activating the vox.
"Prime Tertiary, be advised. I am inbound on the rear of your position."
"Acknowledged, Helix,"
came the reply from Lieutenant Samson. Polixis pounded into the workyard, taking a sharp right into cover behind a conveyance belt for mega smeltery blocks. Terrified-looking Tamarans scrambled to make way for him as heavy slugs cracked overhead. As he entered, he saw that the far wall had been demolished and appeared to be acting as a strong point for a greenskin mob that had entrenched itself in the neighboring ore warehouse. There were 2 other Primaris in cover behind the heavy conveyance belt, brothers Cipran and Caius.
"The lieutenant?"
Polixis asked over the external vox. Caius gestured towards the doorway of the main manufactorum building. Outside it, a haulage lifter had toppled over, providing a length of reinforced plasteel that sheltered more guardsmen. Samson was among them. Polixis broke from behind the conveyance belt and vaulted the lifter's fallen crane, slamming into the gravel beside Samson. The lieutenant didn't look up from the fresh ammunition drum he was clipping into his auto-bolt rifle.
"Just passing through, Helix?"
he asked, using the apothecary's battle-cant signifier.
"Yes. Your situation is stable, Lieutenant?"
"Keeping the beast's attention on us,"
Samson said, nodding to Cipran and Caius, the latter of whom leant over the conveyance belt to ease off a burst of bolt rifle fire.
"Faustus is taking a combat team north around their flank. We should be moving on within the next 10 minutes.
"I'm needed with the captain," Polixis said, glancing once more at the tactical display.
Brother Ovido's vitae signs were crashing.
"Fastest way is to the right,"
Samson said, nodding to the workyard's north wall. Covering fire on my mark. Polixis broke from behind the crane as the thunder of bolters filled the workyard. The sudden fury seemed to only encourage the orcs, who returned fire with a chorus of howls and roars. Shots sparked around Polixis, but none touched him as he hammered pauldron first into the red brick wall. The masonry gave way with a crash. He carried on through the broken rubble and dust, finding himself in an alley running parallel to the workyard, presumably the same one taken from the manufactorum by Faustus en route to the greenskin's flank. He took the first right into a grimy, deserted inner-city Hab Street. An orc scrap truck lay at the far end, burning, surrounded by an indiscriminate litter of greenskin and guard dead. The bodies were brutalized, the full savagery of the two races' antagonism clear in eviscerating blows and point-blank weapon blasts. The air filled with a familiar, furious shriek as a cruciform shape shot overhead, dangerously close to the jagged tops of the ruined refinery stacks. The Imperial Navy lightning fighter was pursued by a crude orc aircraft, its autocannons blazing. The contrast between the two races could not have been clearer. The sleek, war-ready Imperial machine, and the brute, ramshackle Xenos engine, its ugly form riveted and bolted together in haphazard fashion. The mere sight of it stirred Polixis's disgust. Both flyers were out of sight again in an instant, a scattering of hot brass falling around Polixis as ejected cartridges sprayed across the street. The apothecary paused briefly to assess his map, continuously updated with feedback from the linked auto-sensors of the rest of the company spread across the city. The distant shellfire was now altogether closer, and he could see a haze of smoke rising above the Hab units directly ahead. He sped down a side alley, over a carpet of blackened, shriveled bodies that had been caught in the promethium gout of a flamer. Ahead of him, the refinery square opened up. It had been reduced to a wasteland, pockmarked with craters and the strewn wreckage of human and alien corpses. He passed over a female Voitigan with her ribcage split open by shrapnel, side by side with a greenskin whose head had been half demolished by a bolt round. Beyond them, another human and alien lay intertwined, a Voitigan's bayonet impaled through the beast's eye, while its fists remained clamped around the dead man's throat, both bodies frozen in their death throes. The battle has swept through the open space and continued now on its western side. Polixis could see ultramarines and Voitigan infantry to his left fighting together, engaged in close-quarters firefight with greenskin mobs that had spilled over into a violent melee on the corners of adjoining streets. To his right, a Lehman Russ battle tank lay near the start of a street leading off to the east, gutted by what looked to have been a direct shell strike, flames blazing from the twisted wreckage. Another had made it halfway across the square before a further hit had thrown one of its treads, leaving it slewed to one side and immobilized. Brother Priskor lay against the tank's flank. Polixis crossed the square at a run, the air around him resounding with the fury of the combat playing out barely 50 yards to his left. Priskor's vitae signs were dropping steadily. The apothecary saw why as he approached. The Primaris had lost both legs, presumably to a close-range shell strike. They'd been severed just below the knee plates, two nubs of ripped muscle and skin, blood and stubs of bone. A smear of red on the sooty flagstones of the square marked where he dragged himself to the battle tank's protective bulk. Polixis dropped down beside the wounded ultramarine. Priskor's helmet turned towards him.
"Brother, apothecary, you're a welcome sight."
"Remain still, Brother Priskor," Polixis said, speaking with the brusque tone he fell into automatically during field surgery. "This will not take long."
He plugged a prognosticator into Priskor's left tacit dermal node, linking his armor with that of the wounded Primaris. Polixis's visor display blinked as it updated with fresh data, the diagnostic helm providing him with a full readout of Priskor's body readings.
"Your Laramon cells are working to cease the blood flow," he said, as he uncapped the plasma node latched to his backpack and linked it through the port in Priskor's vambrace. "But you will bleed out before they are able to heal the wound sufficiently.
I am providing you with a transfusion, followed by a cell acceleration stim to hasten the process. That will stabilize you until you can be moved.
Bastard greenskins,
Priscor spat, but said nothing more. Polixis noted the strain indicated on his visor display from the intercessor's left gauntlet, where Priscor was still gripping his bolt rifle. The apothecary activated the transfusion pack, the clear plastic of the plasma node turning a deep red. As it pumped fresh blood into the downed Adeptus Astartes, he slipped the multi-syringe from his Medicaid webbing and flicked the adapter to the coag stim. Priscor made no sound as Polixis jabbed the needle into the port in his right tacit and depressed the plunger. Not for the first time, the apothecary wondered at the strange torture entailed in the existence of a space marine. While his gen-enhanced metabolism meant that pain was more often than not reduced to little more than a dull ache, the changes wrought also ensured that he would remain fully conscious and coherent, except in the direst of circumstances. A human warrior who had suffered similar injuries would have been left barely conscious, but Priscor would be afforded no such respite.
"Your vitae are stabilizing," Polixis told him,
glancing at the display readings as the stim set to work. The pulse of blood from both stumps had been reduced to a slow ooze, congealing around the great scabs that had begun to blotch the hideously torn muscle tissue.
"Your secondary heart should provide sufficient circulation," he went on, "but do not try to move. I have tagged your armor with a retrieval sigil. Provided we do not lose this position, you will be evacuated within the next half an hour."
"You have my thanks, Helix,"
Priscor said, helm turning to look towards the battle raging along the square's western side.
"I know what you're thinking," Polixis said, "but you will not leave the side of this tank. Consider it under your protection until its crew can refit. I will not lose any more of the Fulminata on this campaign."
"I'm no use here,"
Priscor growled.
"You are," Polixis said. "You can tell me where Brother Ovido is."
Priscor pointed towards the melee. His voice shot through with an angry regret.
"He was still with Nerva when I saw him last. If he has fallen, it will be in amongst that."
"Then I am needed elsewhere, brother," Polixis said,
removing the plasma node and capping it, cutting off the transfusion.
"A week in the spear of Macragge's Medicaid Bay, and I will have you fully fitted with bionic substitutes. You'll be back down here with the rest of Nerva before the last of the Xenos have been purged."
"I'll take that as an oath, Brother Apothecary,"
Priscor said sternly as Polixis stood.
"For Ovido's sake."
"For Ovido," Polixis agreed.
He turned west towards the edge of the square and the battle still raging there, and broke once more into a run. As he went, he unclamped his absolver bolt pistol. It was clear to Polixis that the greenskins were on the verge of breaking. He saw a detonation rip through the rear of the alien's mob, wicked metal slicing thick green flesh and sending blood and limbs skywards. He realized that their own artillery across the river had attempted to shift its target zone to account for the Imperial push across the square, but with typical orcish inaccuracy, was overcompensating and now hammering the mobs in the rear still trying to force their way to the front. At the same time, Intercessor Squad Nerva and the single Leman Russ that was still fully functional had been reinforced by a company of Voitican infantry, who were now pouring lasfire down the streets branching from the western side of the square. Faced with the choice of dying beneath their own barrage or throwing themselves at the steadily advancing Imperials, the Greenskins had chosen the latter. As Polixis ran, he located the company banner of the Fulminata. Its blue and white silk fluttered proudly, exactly where he'd expected to see it, at the point where the Greenskins had reached the Imperial line on the rubble-choked corner of one of the refinery blocks, unleashing a swirling melee that threatened to drag in the Voitican platoons on either side. Amidst the flashing blades and churning bodies, the apothecary caught the actinic flash of power weapons and heard a familiar bellow ring out, audible even over the crash of the nearby shelling. He very nearly smiled as he ran. Then the fury of close combat hit, and the honed skills of a warrior bred for nothing but total war took over. Ahead, a greenskin hefted its crude axe to cleave the skull of a wounded Zoitigan guardsman. Polixis fired, his bolt detonating inside the creature's guts, shredding its lower torso. It went down with a bellow next to the guardsman, and Polixis finished it with another shot to the skull. Directly ahead, Brother Tarquin grappled with another greenskin, the Primaris's gladius lodged in the beast's chest. Despite this, it tried to grind its own cleaver deeper into the space where the Space Marine's pauldron met breastplate. Polixis shoulder-charged the orc, throwing it back with a grunt and dragging both weapons free. Before it could recover its balance, he fired again, blowing away half its face in a spray of foul alien gore.
"Brother Ovido," he demanded, half turning to grasp Tarquin's shoulder. "The captain," he grunted, opening fire with his own bolt pistol, aiming past the apothecary as another orc rushed at them, bellowing.
Polixis pressed on. All around him, men, beasts, and the Adeptus Astartes grappled and hacked, stabbed and spat, but it was a blur even to his hyperactive senses. His eyes were fixed on the company banner, grasped high in the fist of ancient Skyrus, lit by the lightning of Captain Demeter's power sword and the blazing Crozius Arcanum of Chaplain Castor. As he broke through to them, he noticed a crumpled body at Skyrus's feet.
"Ovido,"
the standard-bearer said. Polixis didn't require his prognosticator to know that the Primaris was dead. Two heavy slug rounds had punched through his breastplate, cracking the Space Marine's fused ribcage, and almost certainly rupturing both hearts and lungs.
"Brother Apothecary," said Demeter.
The captain was half facing away from him, dragging his power sword from another greenskin corpse.
"Kindly perform your rites."
Polixis knelt beside Ovido. He activated his Narthesium, the advanced medicate tool that encased his left gauntlet, muttering the litany of recovery as he did so. A glance told him the sternal progenoid, the gene seed buried in Ovido's chest, had been damaged beyond recovery by the two shots that had killed him. The secondary, cervical progenoid, however, was not beyond saving. He accessed the emergency sealants around Ovido's gorget, unclamping his helmet with a quiet prayer to the armor's machine spirit.
"Blessed battleplate, yield your fallen brother to me now."
The fallen ultramarine's face was revealed, wrathful in death, pale and stony-eyed, as though still damning the Xenos that had shot him. Maglocking his bolt pistol to his thigh, Polixis used two fingers to close the ultramarine's eyelids, before triggering his Narthesium's carbon alloy chainblade. Combat recoveries were unpleasant at the best of times. The reverence and care that the body of any fallen member of the chapter deserved had to be set aside in favor of measured haste. Polixis sliced the tip of the chainblade along Ovido's throat, cutting the white flesh with a practice stroke. Blood welled bright from the small incision as he deactivated the chainblade and extended the Narthesium Reductor's extractor tube and flesh hooks, sliding it into the cut and keeping the wound from sealing. The thumbnail-sized picked caster above the tube's tip linked with his helmet display, showing him the grey, fleshy gland he sought in Ovido's neck. With a blink click, he triggered the extractor tube's scissor end after it had slid over the progenoid, neatly severing the gland from the connective tissue, embedding it into the larynx. With the gene seed disconnected, Polixis activated the reductor's suction valve. There was a whirring noise as the gland was dragged free from Ovido's flesh and shunted up the extractor tube into one of the sealed cryo-receptacle vials at the Narthesium's rear. As Polixis worked, the slaughter around him continued. His transhuman senses were aware of it, capable of splitting focus between the probing of the extractor and the surrounding thump of axes and the clang of steel on ceramite. He pulled a mortise tag from his plastic Medicaid webbing and inserted it into Ovido's primary breastplate port, just to the left below his fused ribplate, providing a beacon to locate the body later, now that the Battle Brothers' auto-sensors were offline. As Polixis stood, a spray of blood splattered his white armor, a greenskin severed head flying past him from the direction of Captain Demeter.
"He is recovered,"
the apothecary said, speaking the rite of the fallen.
His legacy endures. Brother Priscor? Demeter asked.
Stable.
Then let us press on, Demeter continued, switching to address both the Primaris and the guard over the vox.
The Gorgon lies just ahead, my brothers. Forward!
Castor. An hour since first entering the refinery square, the Fulminata secured the eastern end of the Excelsior Arch. Castor caught sight of the great bridge ahead, scarred by the bombing runs of Imperial Navy marauders, craters riddling its broad expanse. Still it stood. Greenskins packed it from span to span, the mobs thrusting individuals through the holes and over the bridge's sides in their bestial eagerness to reach the east embankment and join the battle raging through Shebat Alpha. The final phases of the day's objectives were at hand. They were to secure the eastern bank of the river. Demeter led the final drive to the bridge. Castor strode to his left, and Polixis to his right, their bolt pistols thundering, the intercessors of Squad Nerva forming a wedge around them, while ancient Skyrus's banner fluttered at the center of their formation. Voitikans kept their flanks clear with volleys of lasfire, the guard maintaining their discipline in the white heat of the close-quarter combat that had been grinding on ever since the refinery square. Reinforcements pressed in from the north and the south, a squadron of Numerian Leman Russ battle tanks, and two companies of Kalistan stormers, relentlessly driving the greenskins towards the banks of the river. That river was the Gorgon, the great, sluggish expanse of polluted water that curved through the heart of Shebat, 2,000 paces from one embankment to the other. The Excelsior was the greatest of six bridges that had once spanned it, from St. Columb's Crossing in the north to the Adamantium Maglev line in the south. A week of Imperial bombing runs in the build-up to the offensive had reduced all but one to broken stubs and rock-crete rubble heaped in the foaming sludge below. Only the Excelsior endured. The bridge's entrance archway lay before the Primaris. Castor could tell that it must once have been an ornate affair, a great stone monument engraved with images showing the industriousness and toil of the city of Shebat. It had been scarred by the brutalities of war, and was now further defiled with the crude iconography of the greenskins. Huge skull effigies and totemic devices had been bolted to its front and sides, and a rickety-looking orc crane had heaped wrecked battle spoil, weapons, armor, even parts of a burned-out Leman Russ, on top of it. The transformation of humanity's great works into a bestial mockery of their former glory sent fresh fire blazing through Castor's veins.
"Drive them into the Gorgon, my brothers!" he bellowed,
charging forwards into the press. Shells fell from across the river, indiscriminate detonations ripping through the embankment zone. Castor realized he was grinning with a rictus of frenzied passion as he set about once more with Salve Imperata, the Crozius crushing skulls and cracking shoulders and ribcages. Demeter joined him. Both his power sword and his boltstorm gauntlet ignited, a crackling tempest of destruction. Castor was partially aware of Polixis on the other side of the captain. The apothecary had drawn Gladius and Absolver bolt pistol, medicate tools exchanged for the implements of butchery. A battle cannon shell pounded into the press of greenskins beneath the archway in front of them, dangerously close to the advancing Primaris. The shockwave battered the space marines, accompanied by a hail of shattered rockcrete and body parts. The blast cleared a space ahead, affording the ultramarines a break in the melee. It was then that word crackled over the captain's earpiece.
"The spear strikes!"
he relayed to those around him. The words had barely been uttered when the heavens parted. A spear of light lanced down from above. Its brightness imprinted itself even on the lumen dampeners of the ultramarines' visors, searing a perfect circle in the ashen clouds. The light struck the ground directly across the river, the point of impact obscured by the warehouse blocks lining the opposite bank. There was a burst of brilliance, followed by a thunderclap like the closing of the Eternity Gate. The warehouses shuddered, and seconds later the shockwave hit the east side of the river, buffeting man and orc with the fury of a gale. Castor lowered his head into the storm, stabilizers activating once again. He felt debris striking his armor, ricocheting off his legs, torso, and pauldrons, and making his vestments whip about him. The Rockcrete underfoot shuddered, the city shaken to its very core. The shockwave passed. The light blinked from existence, replaced now by a great pillar of black smoke that began to rise towards the torn sky. The spear of Macragg had struck, an orbital bombardment that had obliterated the Orc artillery positions firing from across the river. The shellfire ceased. The stunned hush that followed didn't last long. There was a cracking sound, and the ground shook once more. The crack rose to a crash, echoing back from the ruins bordering onto the river, and overlaid by the howling of thousands of alien throats. Castor realized that the Excelsior Arch, battered for days by munition payloads, was finally breaking in the aftershock of the Spear of Macragge's strike. He lowered Salve Imperator and watched as the great bridge began to collapse. The arch closest to the west bank gave way first, plunging hundreds of greenskins into the broken rockcrete and toxic slurry of the river below, the Xenos struggling and clawing at one another as they were slowly dragged under. The rest of the great bridge followed arch by arch, the air filling with the sound of ruination as the city of Shabbat was split in half. The destruction only ended 100 paces from the east bank's defiled entrance archway, the last of the bridge's masonry crumbling away to leave behind a jagged stub of stonework, the last remnants of Excelsior's majesty. As the echoes of the collapse began to fade, the Imperial forces redoubled their assault. The surviving greenskins trapped on the east bank were cut down, bolt rounds and lasbolts bursting apart their toughened hides and crude scrap armor. Castor strode ahead of the advance, unheeding now of the orcs dying around him. He entered the shadow of the archway, the stonework soaring above him, and turned back the way he had come. Before him were his battle brothers, stained and scarred by the day's fighting, and either side of them the stern-faced men of the guard, bloodied, but with victory gleaming in their eyes.
"Brothers!"
the chaplain bellowed, voice amplified to a thunderous exhortation.
"The day is ours! In the Emperor's name we have purged, and by his will we shall do so again. Today we have reclaimed half of this great city. Tomorrow we retake the other half. Ave Imperator!"
The response, issued from human and transhuman throats alike, was deafening. Chapter 2 Falling Skies. Castor. By late afternoon, the Aquila was flying once again above the Basilica of St. Albarac the Smelter. The echoing, decrepit ecclesiarchy headquarters had been the primary objective of the northernmost Imperial salient assault. According to the after-action reports being logged on Castor's display, it had fallen almost without a fight, largely abandoned by the greenskins as they had flocked to engage the Fulminata's drive to the Gorgon. Now it was the headquarters of the combined Imperial Command in Shebat Alpha. Castor watched as a harried-looking ministorum deacon hurried from pillar to pillar, applying tinctures of blessed oil and muttering the canticles of purification. Orderly staff officers began flooding the nave and apse, setting up the paraphernalia of military command. A humming power generator was inserted into the ambulatory, fussed over by red-cowled tech adepts. Thick clusters of cabling led to a hollow chart assembled in the chancel, beneath the remains of the altar. More lines were tacked to the narrow stone casements leading to the basilica's belfry, where the headquarters communication hub had been established, hard-wired in case signals became blocked or scrambled. Physical charts, troop rosters, and orders of battle were pinned up to the bullet-scarred walls of the apse, and the whole echoing space was soon illuminated by jury-rigged lumen strips that buzzed with electrical charge. A flakboard sentry post was being constructed outside, and sandbags and ablative shielding heaped around the broken windows and entrances. Castor lent his own prayers to the work of the ecclesiarchy, seeking to reconsecrate the old stonework around him. As night fell, Field Marshal Kloss arrived with his senior staff and a detail of Tempestus scions who took up security rotations around the former place of worship. Captain Demeter was present as well, a giant in his blue gravis armor, dwarfing the humans scurrying about his feet. an extensive debrief of the day's engagements began, along with final planning and preparation for the next day's push. Castor and Polixis removed themselves early and passed together down into the vaults. The space was being converted into a reserve armory bunker, stocked with crates of supplies to be used should shelling force the headquarters staff underground. The Primaris had passed through the echoing dank spaces to a familial offshoot, a branch of alcoves owned, according to the crumbling lettering, by the great Shabbat industrialist family, the Fazals. There, on one of the tomb slabs not yet occupied, they laid out the body of Brother Ovido. Castor lit the stone alcove with the wan light of a trio of electro candles. He watched in silence while Polixis worked. Tech Marine Tiberon had already removed the Intercessor's blessed Mark X power armor and armaments for repair and reuse. Polixis now harvested his body. Those organs that could still be implanted into future generations of the Ultramarines chapter were extracted one by one, before being placed carefully in white cryo units stamped with the helix sigil of the Apothecarian.
Spirit of the Emperor's righteous servant, accept your removal from the flesh of your warring vessel, Polixis murmured. Stay true, that you may imbue the future of the chapter with vengeful purpose.
Castor listened as Polixis continued to recite the rites of recovery, his brother's gauntlets and Narthesium red with Ovido's blood. The crumbling old tomb space filled with the soft rending of flesh and the surgical buzz of chainblade and drill bit. The final organs were removed, joining the precious, lone progenoid that had already been sealed into the main cryo unit. Ovido lay like a demonstration piece for space marine physiology, his rib plate split open, remaining organs exposed to the cold, dank air. Polixis set to work sewing the sliced flesh back together, working with a speed and precision that none but the most experienced human surgeons or mortuary attendants could have matched. Eventually, with Ovido's remains bound by rows of neat black stitching, he nodded wordlessly to Castor. The chaplain, his skull helm even more sinister in the flickering candlelight, took a step forwards to stand over the slab and the body that lay atop it.
Blessed Emperor of Man, Saviour of our race, look down upon us now as we recall the deeds of a brother fallen in your service.
The words sounded through the old crypt, as dark as the shadows that stretched and yawned around the space marines. Polixis bowed his head while Castor intoned the chapter's funerary rites, commending the soul of Ovido to the Emperor and to the honored forebears who had fought for mankind's preeminence for over 10,000 years.
He held the breach at Qatar, alongside Scaevola and Tullio, for 8 Terran hours, until reinforcement could be made, the chaplain said, listening to the fallen's greatest achievements. At Lorenzis, he destroyed 12 heretical war engines, single-handedly. Against the cult of the Fivefold, he was grievously wounded, while ensuring the safety of Brother Ronus. Who else among the assembled recalls his deeds? I remember him at Patricia's Lawn, Polixis responded. I remember him at the Cab Pass. He helped me to stabilize Brother Tars from then Squad Drusus. Tars would have fallen that day without him. Now he is an honored sergeant in the 2nd Company. That is just one of Ovido's many legacies.
Ovido's brethren from Squad Nerva should have been present to recount their personal memories of the fallen. Such a thing was not possible, with the Intercessor Squad holding the east bank of the Gorgon through the hours of darkness, and in truth, to receive a full remembrance while the company was still combat effective was rare. The Codex Astartes called for honor and reverence, but also practicality as far as the dead were concerned. Ovido had been a Mars-born Primaris, like many still among the Fulminata, so his body would have no resting place within the realm of Ultramar. Once back on board the Spear of Macragge, it would be cremated, and its ashes fired into the void, a last tribute in an uncaring and brutal galaxy. Castor closed the small ceremony with the final rites, making the sign of the Aquila over the pale corpse. Afterwards, the two Primaris stood in silence for a while, the only noise the distant scrape and thud of more supplies being hauled down to the adjacent crypts by guard orderlies.
"Priscor lives?"
Castor asked eventually.
"Yes. He's been shuttled to the Spear of Macragge. Artemer is tending to him until I can relocate. She reports that he is in a stable condition."
The compiece in Castor's ear blurted, a sudden jagged spike of static overlaying a few incoherent words. After a few seconds, it returned to silence. The signal in the crypts was almost non-existent.
"Squad Nerva will want vengeance," Castor went on. "I must be careful to channel their hatred towards its proper end."
"That is your prerogative," Polixis said.
"I sense there is more you wish to say," Castor continued, after Polixis went no further. "Speak your mind, my brother. You have seemed reticent these past few days. Our brothers may not notice, Polixis, but we came from the same womb. You cannot hide this from me." "Every squad, bar the Reavers, has now suffered at least one fatal casualty since making planetfall," Polixis said, looking from Avido's body to his blood brother, the chaplain. "The Xenos have been driven back on all fronts, but they still control vast swathes of Ikara. Even this city is only halfway to being cleansed. At the current rate, our casualties are only just sustainable."
"I am sure Captain Demeter is aware of that," Castor said.
"But it would be remiss of me not to mention it," Polixis said. "You are the guardian of this company's spirit, my brother, but I am responsible for their bodies. It is my duty."
"You wish for me to mention it to the captain," Castor surmised.
"He will be expecting me to take issue with our losses. That is part of my role, after all. Hearing it from you will carry a greater weight."
More static chopped in over the vox. Both Primaris ignored it. Castor went on.
"You know him as well as I, brother. He does not take the death of a single ultramarine lightly. Our mode of warfare on this world is dictated by circumstance. We have no intelligence pertaining to the Xenos warlord leading the aliens here, and without the ability to land a single precise blow, our place is bolstering the guard. You saw what we achieved out there today. How many weeks would be required, and how many thousands more would have fallen had the humans been forced to fight their way to that river, street by street, without us?
We are bred for war, and losses are inevitable," Polixis said, the words sounding tired and heavy.
"I long ago accepted that. But if we cannot find a means to shorten this conflict, few of us will leave this world." "I will speak with the captain," Castor repeated. "As should you. I am certain the matter is already on his mind."
There was yet another jagged spurt of static over the vox. A cold feeling settled over Castor, a foreboding instinct born of more than a century of combat. He could tell from the slight shift in his brother's stance that he had felt it too.
"Something's wrong," the apothecary said.
Without another word, the two Primaris strode from the alcove, Polixis motioning to the four chapter serfs in their blue shifts waiting outside to enter and seal Avido's remains in the black plastic body bag they carried between them. They made for the stone stairs leading back up to the basilica, supply orderlies in the uniform of the Departamento Munitorum hurrying to get out of their way. It was only when they emerged into the ambulatory behind the basilica's apse that the vox signal cleared and the full weight of what was unfolding became apparent. The sudden surge in vox traffic was originating from high orbit. From the snatches of ongoing conversation that the Space Marines' vox beads were picking up, it sounded as though there was a full-scale stand-to among the Imperial Navy fleet anchored above Ikara 9. They rounded the ambulatory and entered the chancel, where the holo chart had been set up. Bodies crowded around it, sweat-streaked and pale in the unforgiving brightness of the makeshift lumen arrays. There were guard corps commanders in the field dress of their respective regiments, signals officers, the Munitorum Quartermaster Primary, and the commander of the local Ikaran elements, all chattering nervously, while two Adeptus Mechanicus adepts bent over the chart's regulator relay. Castor noted the presence of Field Marshal Stefan Kloss, son of Lord General Helgar Kloss, one of the heroes of Cadia, a decorated Astra Militarum commander whose face bore as many jagged scars as Demeter's. The captain was also among them. He had cleaned and anointed his Gravis armor in the hours immediately following the day's engagement, and now he towered over the officers and staff aides, gleaming and untouchable. His helm was maglocked to his hip, and his viciously scarred features were stern and silent, thrown into strange contrasts by the lights from the lumens above and the glow of the chart below. The humans nearest him hurried to make way as Castor and Polixis joined him on either side.
"Brethren," he said, "Brother Ovido has received the final rites."
"He has, brother captain," Castor said.
Both the chaplain and the apothecary had removed their helmets as they approached the chart, conscious of Demeter's orders that they present their faces as often as possible around their human allies. Being seen as anything other than unyielding automata was not something that concerned most Adeptus Astartes, but like many of Gilliman's favored, the captain of the Fulminata seemed to be as much a diplomat as he was a soldier. According to Demeter, showing the human soldiers and citizens of the Imperium that they were flesh and blood had a multitude of morale benefits. Polixis understood the reasoning, though he knew that Castor considered it a foolish affectation. The chaplain respected Demeter enough, however, to adhere to the ruling in his presence. Without their helms, Castor knew he and the apothecary's shared lineage was laid bare. Both had the same firm jawline, accentuated by the natural bulk and solid bone structure of all Primaris, though Castor bore the scars of a Tyranid's claws that marked him out from his brother. Both had the same hair, as golden as a full Iaxian harvest, though Polixis wore his cropped closer to the scalp. Most clearly of all, both had the same pale grey eyes, wintry and discerning. In the face of a human being, they might have been described as thoughtful, even sad. There was no denying that, even accounting for the transitional similarities common to the genetics shared by all Ultramarines, Castor and Polixis had been brothers before the beginning of their first initiation rites.
"There is a situation, Captain," Castor asked, as both Primaris surveyed the holochart. It had been beaming a sea-green projection of Shebat and its surrounds, the great polluted sweep of the Gorgon and the arid peaks of the Tombstone Mountains that lay immediately to the west and south. Parts of that map were dissolving now and being replaced with a star chart showing the Icarus system, its constituent planets and moons, and the positions of Imperial fleet elements. Sections of the display continued to blink and update as auger and sensorium data filtered through, overseen by the two tech adepts laboring to keep the hololithic chart connected.
"Situation is an understatement," said Field Marshal Kloss, speaking for the first time. He smacked one palm into the holochart's glassy surface, causing the entire three-dimensional display to flicker.
"They've caught us cold, Throne, damn them. How many times have I told High Command not to underestimate these beasts?"
"A Xenos fleet has just completed a warp jump into Ikaran real space," Demeter explained to Castor and Polixis. "Dangerously close to the system core."
"How close?" Castor asked, eyes on the chart.
Green skull runes, no doubt representing Orc capital ships, were starting to appear amidst the stellar cartography.
"You heard the Ultramarine,"
Kloss snapped at a bald, corpulent Navy attaché in the starched green dress uniform of the Segmentum battle fleet.
"How close?"
The man jumped, all but cringing beneath the sudden, intense scrutiny. His eyes darted over the chart readings.
I think perhaps 4 hours, my lord, if they maintain their initial heading and speed."
"Perhaps,"
Kloss snarled, smacking the chart again.
"Perhaps just about sums this all up. Throne, damn it all, Morellin."
He snapped his fingers at a white-uniformed man with the heavy aural augmetics of a guard vox chief.
"Have you got Lord Commander von Klimt on the line yet?"
No, sir,
Morlin said, one hand going up to the device sutured into the side of his skull as he filtered the communications traffic reaching the headquarters.
His aide claims he's still in an emergency holo conference with Rear Admiral Corran.
Demeter had said nothing since Kloss's arrival, but as the Field Marshal opened his mouth to utter another string of invectives, the Space Marine raised his right gauntlet. The motion was slight, yet it caused even the gruff Cadian to pause.
"Captain Spaulding," the Ultramarine said levelly, "can you offer us a professional opinion on the size of the enemy fleet that has just entered real space?"
"Their numbers are still updating,"
the Navy officer replied hesitantly.
"But the system's auger station and the fleet's sensorium arrays have confirmed at least 5 capital ships, with between 3 and 5 more currently being assessed. Escort numbers remain unverified, but it is undoubtedly a major incursion. The subsector battle fleet elements anchored in high orbit are probably outnumbered a little over 2 to 1.
"It can only be the fleet of Warlord Ur-Gork himself, then," Demeter said. "He has brought the forefront of the war to this system."
"As I feared," Kloss said. "I warned von Klimt about this. 2 weeks ago, the Greenskin offensive in the Arden system stalls. 2 weeks ago, we retake Priscilla and secure the Ior salient. Why? Because they've shifted their center of power. They've moved their focus, their strength of mass, to here, to this system. 2 weeks is a short warp jump from Arden. 2 weeks, and they redeploy their primary elements here and crush us, turning the flank on the whole subsector defense. Sometimes I think those damned Xenos could teach our High Command a thing or two."
Custer growled, a gauntlet on the haft of his mag-locked Crozius.
"Careful, Field Marshal."
To his credit, even Kloss appeared to immediately regret his words, blanching at the black-armored Space Marine's ire.
"If Ur-Gork's fleet is approaching, our own in-system elements will be overwhelmed," Demeter went on.
From anyone else around the chart, it would have sounded like defeatism. From the Primaris, it came across merely as carefully considered fact. He continued.
"An evacuation would also be impossible before they reach orbit."
"So we engage the bastards,"
Kloss said, recovering his brashness.
"At the very least, we can give the neighboring systems time to readjust, maybe even dispatch reinforcements. We can sell our lives dearly here."
"I suspect that will be our fate, Field Marshal," Demeter agreed. "But it is pointless to sacrifice that which can be saved. I recommend the subsector battle fleet conducts a fighting retreat to the edge of the system, to either hold there for reinforcements or complete a warp jump withdrawal."
"You want to yield orbit to the Xenos?" Kloss said incredulously. "That would give them immediate planet-wide air superiority. They'd fill the skies with their scrap bombers and launch orbital strikes with impunity."
"That is the situation we will find ourselves in when our own fleet elements are destroyed,"
Demeter pointed out.
"How long do you believe Rear Admiral Corran can hold out for? A Terran day, at the most? The sacrifice of significant elements of the Imperial Navy would provide us with almost no tangible advantage."
Kloss said nothing, eyes fixed on the holochart, as he digested the Ultramarine's words. Demeter continued.
"I will be transmitting instructions for a fighting withdrawal to my own flagship within the next 30 minutes. The shipmaster will recommend the same course of action to the Rear Admiral."
"I doubt von Klimt will suggest anything similar to Corran," Kloss said. "The fool will probably want him to attack head-on."
"Then he will find himself without the support of the Spear of Macragge," Demeter replied.
"Lords,"
said Spaulding tentatively, gesturing at the holochart. A new sigil had blinked into life on the display, an orc glyph, larger than the others clustered around it.
"What is it? Ur-Gork's flagship?"
Kloss demanded, peering at the data readouts accompanying the marker designate.
No, said Spaulding. It's worse. Much worse.
Xerxes. Shipmaster Xerxes broke the Voxlink and sat back in his command throne. Beneath him, the bridge of the Spear of Macragg lay in silence, the faces of 100 deck officers turned up towards him in expectation. The Spartan work surfaces, cogitator banks, and Vox relays gleamed in the light cast by the lumen strips and picked screen stands. Even the servitors, ranking the gantries that ringed the command dais, had gone into standby, awaiting the fresh bursts of coding cant that would give them purpose. Xerxes gestured towards the auger banks and spoke.
Diagnosticator, bring me the latest sensorium readout from Quadrant 9, Sector 13. Remove all incomplete variables prior to transference.
The order was not the one the bridge serfs had expected. The Spear of Macragg's auger staff hurried to obey, filtering the data and transmitting it directly to the shipmaster. Xerxes swiped and enhanced the slates built into the arms of his command throne, his gen-hanced mind analyzing it all in just a few heartbeats. The auger returns didn't lie. Xerxes saw his fears confirmed in the first grainy picked scans of the target area. There was a behemoth at the heart of the Orc fleet that had just torn itself from the warp and was now approaching the system's core at full steam ahead, plasma drives blazing. Going by the designates Imperial Strategos attempted, often in vain, to apply to the ramshackle alien void vessels, it was a battleship, longer and bulkier than even an Emperor-class capital vessel of the Imperial Navy. That was not what gave Xerxes pause, however. It was the thing attached to the Orc craft.
Heavy customization, he murmured to himself. Extra armor bulk and engine housing. It's a transport.
He trailed off. The scans showed that it was coupled to what appeared to be a large sphere of void-borne rock, a meteorite of fused and scarred stone. Its craggy surface was studded with more Orc structures and plasma drives of its own, which blazed in sympathy with those of its carrier. A great skull glyph in its underside seemed to glare at Xerxes through the grainy images he swiped through, full of alien malice.
Rock,
Xerxes said. It was a method of planetary invasion so crude and so mindlessly brutal that only the Greenskins could possibly have conceived of it. An asteroid or meteorite would be seized by an Orc fleet and mined, installed with plasma drives that would enable the aliens to steer it to their own course. Thus directed, it would be flung at a target world, crash-landing with enough force to annihilate any planetary defences. Those Greenskins within that survived the impact would then disgorge and slaughter the stunned defenders. The rock's only weakness was the fact that they rarely, if ever, were capable of warp travel. They could be detected far out on the fringes of a system, engaged and neutralized. They possessed no warp drives. This one, however, did. The battleship had acted as its carrier. It would deliver it directly to Ikara. Of that, Xerxes had no doubt. The soft voice of the Spear of Macragge's signals officer disturbed Xerxes's thoughts.
Rear Admiral Corrin is awaiting a connection, Lord. Put him on the throne box, Xerxes ordered, activating his personal earpiece.
The static, chopped voice of the Navy Admiral crackled in his ear.
Word from downstairs, Shipmaster, he said. Lord Commander von Klimt has given my fleet discretion to engage or withdraw as I see fit.
My company commander has ordered me to mount a fighting retreat to the system's edge, Xerxes replied. If we attempt to hold this anchorage, we will likely be surrounded and destroyed in detail.
Agreed, Corrin said.
I sense a degree of reluctance, Rear Admiral, Xerxes said.
Leaving one of the God Emperor's worlds undefended before a ramshackle conglomerate of Xenos scum doesn't sit well, Corrin admitted.
I agree. Perhaps a compromise. From their current speed, I don't believe the main body of the Xenos fleet will be able to overtake us. We should be able to engage their vanguard and still withdraw without becoming committed to a full fleet action. And while we're at it, perhaps we might attempt to strike a blow at that monstrous payload they have bound for Ikara.
Agreed, Corrin said. If you wish to take the lead, the Pride of Makaroth and Lance of Vengeance will support you.
We have been given discretion to conduct a fighting withdrawal, Xerxes said. So let's fight, Rear Admiral.
Good hunting, Ultramarine.
The connection ended. Xerxes looked out across the bridge once more, taking in the expectant silence before issuing the order.
All hands, clear for action.
Urgork. Morcopolips was ready. Urgork bashed his skinning blades together, the huge, wickedly serrated weapons clanging out over the bridge of the Worldhammer. Slyboy, the orc warboss's blind seer, cringed back from his master's exuberance.
"Here we go, Sly, ya git!"
Urgork bellowed, grinning from tusk to tusk. He thumped one of his great blades into the decomposing squig corpse sagging beside his trophy-laden chair, and snatched the orc psyker by the throat with his now free hand, hauling the runty greenskin close.
You better have got this one right,
he snarled, gristle-flecked spit splattering the weird boy. The smaller orc squirmed and choked, nodding vigorously in the warlord's grasp.
Tell me!
Urgork trailed off into incoherent stammers, tusks grinding together. His body seemed to freeze up, a twitch tugging at his scarred face, one eye rolling back into its socket while the other dilated. Slyboy's legs beat the air in panic as the warboss's grip continued to tighten, slowly choking him.
Grok!
Urgork managed to growl from between his locked jaws, foam building around his maw. A greenskin scurried up the ladder to the boss chair dais, a hunchbacked, wheezing creature clad in a greasy white smock, black leather glove gauntlets, and grimy goggles. He fumbled with a dirt-encrusted syringe as the warlord started to spasm violently, shaking the near-unconscious Slyboy back and forth like a rag doll. The bent-over pain boy, syringe finally readied, lunged forwards with a yelp and stabbed it into the meat of the warboss's thigh, using both hands to inject a huge load of viscous-looking yellow liquid. Urgork's head snapped back. He let out a shuddering gasp as both eyes refocused. His hand unclenched, and Slyboy clanged to the deck, choking and retching. Grok yanked the syringe out and backed away, twitching nervously. The warboss lowered his head again, slowly flexing his neck and shoulders. Bones crunched and popped. The savage seizure that had gripped him was gone. He nodded to Grok.
My thanks, Doc.
Slyboy had used the few seconds' respite to attempt to crawl away, feeling his way blindly through the detritus littering the command deck. Urgork grunted and snatched him by the scruff of the neck.
Tell me again, Sly, he growled. Tell me of division.
There's all down there, boss,
the pitiful orc mewled.
All the hard boys in their big ruined city.
And the one in white, too?
Yeah, boss, course.
And you got Big Mech Cog Crusher, the proper coordinates,
Urgork demanded.
Yeah, boss, I swears.
Urgork grunted again and released the weird boy.
Then it's time,
he said, yanking his second skinning blade from the squig corpse.
Grok, stand close,
he barked. When the hunched pain boy was crouched next to his boss's chair, he slammed the hilt of one of his blades into a huge red button that was wired crudely into the arm of the seat. Nothing happened. Urgork sighed and hit it again. There was a violent lurch and a scream of rusting gears as juddering motion seized the chair. It began to descend, disconnecting from the circular dais around it, sinking down into the deck with an unhealthy rattle. Urgork's grin returned as he was carried down, down from his flagship, through its refuse-clogged holds,
and then on into more Morcopolips. The great hollowed-out meteorite was packed full of the boys, its multiple decks resounding with the chanting of individual mobs and warbands as they worked themselves into a battle frenzy. The platform on which the boss chair sat passed each open level one by one. As it went by, Urgork bellowed and slammed his long knives together. Each passing deck roared back its approval, driven into a mania by the presence of their war boss. He watched as an orc knocked down another in one of the mobs, a fight breaking out instantly as individual boys vented their mounting battle frenzy in the only way they knew how. This was gonna be a right proper scrap when it all kicked off. Finally, the platform clattered to a stop, the crudely modified grav lift levered into the control room at the rock's heart. Stapskar and his chief knob, Grimtooth, were waiting for Urgork, in among Big Mech Cogcrusher and his tinkerers. Urgork gestured to the commando boss with one claw. Stapskar forced his way to the chair's side and bowed low, his soiled camo cape draping the mesh decking plates.
"You and your boys know your job, Stabber," the warlord demanded.
"Course, boss. We won't let you down again."
"Then let's go,"
Urgork bellowed, slamming the pommels of both knives into the flanks of his chair.
"What are we waiting for?" "Orbital entry,"
Cogcrusher said, after a moment's silence, the big mech's voice like the rattle of rusty gears. Urgork glowered.
"Fine,"
he grunted.
"Won't be long now, boss,"
Cogcrusher clattered, bionic optics clicking as they focused on the control room's plethora of cracked, mismatched viewscreens.
"The Humi ships is coming for a scrap."
Polixis. The evening sky above Ikara 9 was riven by fire as new stars burst into brief, furious life overhead. Most of those on the planet's surface saw little but indistinct flares amidst the grey smog that blanketed the polluted atmosphere, but the wind that sometimes knifed down from the tombstones was blowing a gale as night fell, affording Polixis a view of the full fury of an orbital engagement playing out. He watched the silent flashes and flares light up the dark from the steps of the Basilica of St. Albarak, the smelter. Demeter and Castor were still inside. The feverish activity of the headquarters had entered overdrive, with an immediate planet-wide stand-to being issued. Orders coming out of Croton seemed to be rudderless, sometimes contradictory. Demeter had passed on word that Shipmaster Xerxes and Rear Admiral Corrin were going to engage the vanguard of the Xenos fleet before withdrawing, an act that Demeter had left to Xerxes's discretion. With nothing to contribute to the command and control of the developing situation, Polixis had taken his leave. The Basilica Square lay before him, quiet and wrapped in nighttime shadows. The broken remains of a Chimera armored personnel carrier sat where it had been gutted by an Orc rocket earlier in the day. Alien bodies had been heaped in one far corner and burned by flamer-armed purification teams, their stinking, charred remains now smouldering in the dark. Much of the rest of the square had been taken up by mortuary orderlies, who had laid out row after row of dead Imperial guardsmen, clad in the black plastic wraps of Munitorum-issue body bags. Bar a few off-duty troopers, smoking lows and talking quietly near the foot of the steps, and an ecclesiarchy preacher moving along the dead ranks, sprinkling blessed salve, the square was empty. Polixis briefly pondered the curious similarities between the dead below and Ovido's body lying in the crypt beneath him. The sheer scale of the Astra Militarum's losses made it tempting to think of their deaths as more impersonal, almost meaningless. But in truth, Polixis knew the difference between the fallen was more slender than it seemed. All had fallen in the cause of mankind. All had received a blessing over their remains. All would live on in the memories of their battle brothers. As far as Polixis was concerned, the sacrifice was one and the same. He turned his eyes once more to the distant, deadly beauty of the unfolding high-orbit engagement, his mind continuing to wander. The litanies he had memorized as an initiate spoke so often of the importance of legacy and heritage, of how, through his gene seed, an Adeptus Astartes could live forever. Once he had doubted such claims. No conscious memory remained. All else was mere metaphor. Future battle brothers learned the names of those who had gone before, and their many deeds, and perhaps their breasts swelled with pride, knowing they bore a part of them inside. But it was all so much history. But such doubts had only plagued Polixis when he had still been young, still grappling with his new existence. He knew better now. Individuality meant nothing.
The purpose of us all is to fight and to sacrifice ourselves when we can fight no more, Polixis murmured to himself as he watched the sky, letting the induction litany of the apothecarian ease his thoughts. To pass on our own gene seed, so that another can serve the chapter when we no longer can.
There was perhaps extra poignancy in the fact that Ovido had been Mars-born, among the first of his kind. A little over half of the Fulminata were the same. They had come to Ultramar, to Macrag, and painted their Mark X power armor the blue of the Ultramarines. They had learned the chapter's doctrines by rote, fought and bled and died beside their new brothers, but they had not been from Ultramar, nor even from the 500 worlds. They were the first of their kind, the first Primaris, forged on a distant red planet by a being far beyond the understanding of any of them. Polixis was not Mars-born. He was from the realm of Ultramar, a son of the Agri-world of Ajax, the first Primaris Ultramarine to be recruited from the worlds the Chapter called home. One of the first, he corrected himself, silently, as his blood brother came out onto the Basilica's steps to join him. Polixis nodded. Castor said nothing, looking to the sky. The occasional silent flash of a macro-cannon broadside, or the blink-beam of a lance-strike reflected from the glossy black sheen of his power armor. Neither of them spoke. A memory intruded as Polixis watched his brother. He remembered looking up at the spread of stars, lying on his back, limbs aching from a long day's toil. The night air had been warm and quiet and full of the sweet musk of the harvest cycle. The medicate in him explained the sudden recollection easily enough. It was nothing more than the firing of brain synapses, a shadow in an abandoned room that vanished with the coming of light. Such flashes were not unheard of among the first generation of Primaris born within the realm of Ultramar. Polixis understood better than most that, for all their prowess as warriors, the creation of new Primaris was not a perfect process. Castor could sometimes summon up what appeared to be perfectly clear memories of their shared childhood. For Polixis, it was far harder. His past was relegated to these half-moments, so slender and so fine that they felt unreal. His training as an apothecary helped him rationalize them as a simple, minor failing in his induction process. Once, perhaps, he had reclined in the agri-fields of Ajax, maybe close to the collective that he called home, with his brother at his side, watching the night sky. It didn't matter. He told himself that whenever the shadow memories stirred. Those agri-fields were long gone now, and that starry sky had been ripped in half by the stuff of nightmares. "What news, brother?" he asked Castor, deliberately breaking the contemplative stillness.
"From orbit," Castor replied, eyes still on the starry vault. "Xerxes has engaged. He is attempting to target the rock, but the Xenos have it well shielded. He will be forced to withdraw within the hour." "And from High Command?" "Von Klimt is demanding reinforcements for Croton. He expects that to be the rock's target. Gloss has agreed to send his reserve. 2 corps. They're mobilizing as we speak." "This will be bloody," Polixis said, eyes on the guardsmen in the square below. "It is a blessing," Castor replied, his voice low but tinged with relish.
When Polixis said nothing, he went on.
"The Xenos' supreme warlord will be among their fleet. He has come here to fight. Of that there can be no doubt. He presents us with an opportunity. Slay him, and his dominion over the green-skinned tribes he commands will end. They will fragment, as they always do, and this war will turn at a stroke.
kill Warlord Urgork, and the subsector will be cleansed before the year is out.
You are fortunate, my little brother, to always be able to find a bloodthirsty positive among our dire circumstances. Were a whole company at our side, I may share your optimism. We have here only half strength, and we have suffered losses.
The captain knows how to use what he has, Castor said, his voice full of certainty. Once the Xenos leader commits himself, we shall strike.
It is already decided, then?
It is. Word is being passed to Lieutenant Samson and Tyrannus. We are preparing to move with the Dawn. Croton is presumably their target, so we will go there, too.
Has the captain told Field Marshal Kloss?
He is doing so now. I doubt there will be many objections. The Field Marshal is brash, for a human. His ire is focused on his commanding general, and the fact that he is expected to send his reserves to support him.
He will need them here, I imagine, Polixis said. As soon as the warbands across the river realize their fleet has seized orbit, they will attempt a counterattack.
It is only a shame that we will not still be here to greet them, Castor growled.
You seemed eager to purge today, brother, he said, smiling knowingly. Even now, after so long, seeing his younger brother roused to ire brought him a mixture of amusement and something akin to awe.
The Xenos here are weak, Castor said, without any hint of levity, and Polixis could sense the fire that forever smoldered in his brother stirring once more. Even by the oafish standards of their degenerate race, we can see why now. This was only a second front for them. Well, now it has become their primary focus. When the Xenos warlord comes, he will bring his best with him.
A challenge, if nothing else, Polixis said heavily.
As the Emperor wills.
Polixis nodded but said nothing more, as overhead a great flash lit up the sky, illuminating everything beneath for a few seconds, like the birth of a second sun. Somewhere high above, the apothecary knew an entire ship had just died. Xerxes. To a casual observer, the quiet that had reigned over the bridge of the Spear of Macragge had been totally subsumed. The multi-tiered command decks rang with the clatter of proximity alarms and incoming munitions warnings. The communications pits were filled with the hissing, crackling urgency of dozens of vox messages, and cogitators chimed and pinged with reports from weapons systems, the engineerium, the shield generators, and the astrocartography bay. Blue-uniformed runners and rating officers hurried from workstation to workstation, or up the flights of narrow spiral stairs to the upper tiers, polished boots ringing off the mesh rungs and decking plates. Xerxes reigned over it all from his command throne, like a graven colossus in the midst of a bustling town square, immovable, largely silent, his occasional commands issued in clear, measured tones. The bridge of a ship of war as large and as powerful as the Spear of Macragge was never a truly calm place during a full void engagement. The scenes unfolding around the shipmaster were a prime example of a well-drilled and highly dedicated command crew carrying out the tasks they had all performed many times previously. The engagement with the Xenos vanguard seemed to be going well, and the Ultramarine's warship was running at optimum efficiency. But it did not take all of Xerxes's experience to be able to see that unfolding events presaged disaster. His eyes narrowed as he watched the data displays, already anticipating the turning of the tide. The Imperial Navy Avenger-class Grand Cruiser Lance of Vengeance was out of position. It had taken up station starboard of the Spear of Macragge, and it had closed relentlessly with the oncoming vanguard of the Xenos fleet. Rear Admiral Corrin, in tandem with Xerxes, had changed the course of his flagship, the Pride of Makaroth, to engage the Orc escorts from range. Too close, and the trio of Imperial capital ships ran the risk of becoming entangled with the main Xenos fleet bearing down on them. And nor did Xerxes want to risk an Orc boarding action when his battle barge was bereft of its complement of Adeptus Astartes and had only half of its Thunderhawks and none of the Overlords on station.
Keeping the orcs at distance for as long as possible also slowed their arrival to the anchorage point above the city of Croton, the expected target of the alien flagship and its rock payload.
"You've drifted," Xerxes said to himself. He didn't have a voxlink established with the Lance of Vengeance's commander, and he already knew that transmitting anything now would be in vain. Without stasis anchor or a new heading, the Lance of Vengeance was turning on its port broadside, close to the orc fleet. Xerxes knew that its captain, Marrow, had a record of high-risk maneuvers and close encounters, a past that explained his position in charge of an aged, largely outdated grand cruiser like the Lance. Marrow had already complained that the short-range batteries of the Avenger would be completely wasted if unleashed from distance. Xerxes tapped into the vox traffic between Marrow and Admiral Corran, expression grim as the scale of the approaching disaster became more apparent.
"I will have you before the Admiralty Board if you don't disengage immediately, Marrow," Corran shouted.
Marrow's response was a sound of weak affirmation. Xerxes had heard that sort of noise enough times before during void combat, where a man's fate was sealed long minutes before death's slow reach caught up with him. He already knew it was too late. A trio of greenskin escorts, little more than brute conglomerations of welded-together scrap, were triggering their hyperthrust, burning out their oversized plasma drives in violent bursts of sudden speed. Xerxes could only watch the holochart, mapping out the movement of the ships around the Spear of Macragge, as the outmaneuvered Grand Cruisers struggled to turn, Marrow caught in panic between the desire to finish bringing his port batteries to bear and the sudden need to escape. Whichever he chose, his fate was sealed. A point-blank storm of fire from the Lance of Vengeance ripped apart one of the oncoming escorts, dwarfed by the Grand Cruiser's bulk, but the other two made it through. They rammed themselves directly into the Imperial ship's flank. The Spear of Macragge's prow picked casters caught the collision, and Xerxes watched with a dark expression as the first alien warship slammed home. They had been built with just such insanely brutal tactics in mind. Both were wedges of reinforced detritus, created to shield the larger orc ships from incoming fire, and when the time was right, plow indiscriminately into enemy vessels. Xerxes saw bulkheads and the Lance's macro-cannon batteries buckling in slow motion, a ripple of tearing adamantium rupturing the hull and collapsing deck after deck. He knew he was watching the deaths of thousands. He had experienced the same numerous times during void combat, but the remoteness, the silence, and the almost languid slowness of the collapsing capital ship still rendered it all deeply disconcerting. Then the second orc escort hit, this time towards the Lancer's aft, and the grim spectacle reached a crescendo. The impact of the alien vessel against the reinforced plating beneath the Grand Cruiser's bridge tower deflected it, slamming it into the side of the Engenarium block. The plasma drives buckled, then detonated. The blast travelled in a wave of broiling blue flame along the length of the Lance, consuming both it and the battered remains of its killers. As the sunburst flash of total annihilation lit the void, the Spear of Macragge's auger systems overloaded, the picked feeds shorting out before blinking back online. The Lance of Vengeance was gone. All that remained was a scattering of debris, flickering with fires that died out in the vacuum of space.
"Gunner, maintain your rate of fire," Xerxes ordered, then switched to the communications pits. "Get me a link to the Pride of Makaroth."
"Shipmaster Xerxes,"
came Corran's voice over the vox. He sounded strained.
"I believe the time to withdraw has come, Rear Admiral," Xerxes said.
When his words were met with silence, he carried on.
"We have already suffered a blow here for little gain. We must not compound Captain Marrow's mistake."
"You're correct,"
Corran replied, though Xerxes could sense the rage that burned in every word, the desire to avenge the loss of the Lance of Vengeance by throwing the entirety of the battle fleet against the oncoming greenskins.
"I will issue orders for an immediate disengagement."
"The Spear of Macragge will hold station until you have set a course," Xerxes offered,
knowing the Admiral's ponderous flagship would need some time to come about.
"My thanks, Ultramarine,"
Corrin responded. The link went dead.
"Shipmaster, the Xenos are changing formation," one of the Augur attendants called up from the sensorium banks.
Xerxes turned his gaze from the Pride of Makaroth's representation on the holochart back to the alien fleet. The Augur analysis was correct. The sigils were shifting across the display. Until that moment, the alien fleet had remained clustered around its flagship, denying the Imperial long-range bombardment the opportunity to target the Warlord's vessel. Now, however, they were spreading away from it, their cumbersome drives adopting new headings that carried them wide across Ikara's orbit. For a moment, Xerxes thought they were trying to outflank and envelop the Imperial ships before they could pull away. Then the icons that represented the alien fleet blinked. Another had been added by the Augur arrays, adjacent to Urgork's flagship, but pulling away rapidly. Xerxes realized what he was looking at. The flagship had released the rock. Moreover, it had done so early, long before it was positioned in an orbital arc above the capital city of Croton.
"Link to Captain Demeter immediately," he ordered the Vox Seneschal. "Signal to the surface. The sky is about to fall."
Polixis. Polixis saw it first as a twinkling amidst the fiery sky. It grew rapidly, a star burning white as it fell from the war-wracked firmament, a herald of annihilation. The Vox network burst into frantic chatter, garbled orders, reports, and requests for clarification flooding the channels. All eyes in the Basilica Square stared heavenwards as the light grew to a furious intensity.
"May the Emperor and the Primarch be with us all," Castor murmured when he caught sight of the white blaze.
The scream of the plummeting rock filled the air, a roar of bone-shuddering intensity vibrating through every brick and girder in Shabbat. Polixis could do nothing but watch as the light filled the sky, the whole world, its rage like the primordial awakening of a new god. It howled overhead, framed by the basilica's spires, eclipsing the city's ruinous skyline. The strength of its passing threw the guardsmen across the square down to the rubble-littered flagstones. It almost shook even the space marines from their feet. The rock struck. It hit south of the basilica, amongst the remains of the slums near the eastern bank of Gorgon. The impact sounded like the death knell of the whole world, coupled with a flash of light even more brilliant than the destruction of the capital ship in orbit above. Polixis saw the skyline of the city to the south caught like a snap-picked in a moment of perfect clarity, backlit by the fire of the collision. He braced himself. As the report of the meteorite's impact echoed through Shabbat, the shockwave struck. The buildings on the south side of the square, already reduced to bullet-scarred walls and mounds of rubble, crumbled. The blast slammed debris into the square, throwing up the corpses lying there alongside those still living. Both Castor and Polixis were picked up and flung, despite the efforts of their power armor servos and stabilizers, directly back into the wall of the basilica. Polixis grunted, his genhanced body stopping the blow from stunning him or driving the wind from his lungs, even as he felt a section of his armor's backpack unit crumple. He fell to his knees alongside Castor as the wave passed on, the sounds of the rock's impact still ringing in his skull, his lyman's ear failing to cancel out the thunderous noise. The Basilica of St. Albarak, the smelter, still stood. Its foundations had been laid deeper and stronger than any other building in Shabbat Alpha, and though its crypts quaked and stones were shaken from its belfry, the walls remained intact. Polixis regained his feet. The scene of destruction that would undoubtedly have played out before him was lost, completely obscured by the dust cloud that had accompanied the blast wave. Even with his auto-sensors stripping out the haze and boosting what little light there was, he could barely make out the bottom of the basilica's entrance steps. The Vox had also gone silent, the landlines to the main communications hub broken, the impact and the dust distorting the remote channels. For a moment, Polixis felt he and Castor were the only beings left on Ikara, perhaps the only two left in the whole of existence.
There was nothing. Nothing but the swirling of the dust and the low hiss of the vox. A dreadful, languid peace left in the wake of the terrific destruction. It was the quiet of near total extinction.
"The rock,"
Custer said, jolting his brother from the surreal reverie he'd slipped into.
"How far to the south do you think it came down?"
"Within the city limits," Polixis said, starting to move down the steps.
"Where are you going?"
Custer demanded.
"I'm needed elsewhere,"
the apothecary replied, pausing and looking back up at him.
"See to the captain, brother. He will need you now more than ever." "Go carefully," Custer warned. "The Xenos are upon us."
Polixis forced himself not to respond to the obviousness of his blood brother's instructions. He knew that he tried to advise Custer just as frequently. The difference between them was that the chaplain would, more than likely, snap something back at him, whereas Polixis usually managed to hold his tongue and accept the advice. Somehow, he knew this had always been the case. Polixis ran across the square. The autosensors, shared by the Primaris, were still online, still connected. His diagnoster was reading half a dozen injuries, all from squads along the southern edge of Shabbat. Scroll data indicated damage caused by collapsing buildings. Shadows loomed at him from out of the impenetrable dust, limping and stumbling. Anyone in the city not blessed with the genhancements of the Adeptus Astartes had undoubtedly been left stunned by the rock's landing, ears deafened and movements sluggish. The sky itself had come down, and death had followed. Polixis did not stop to assist them. There was worse coming. He knew that thousands of greenskins would be disgorging from the rock, flooding its crater and storming the flattened streets around it. What was worse, they had come down on the Imperial side of the Gorgon, effectively outflanking the gains made by the Guard and the Primaris the day before. With a single great blow, the greenskins had all but reclaimed Shebat Alpha. The apothecary carried on into the rubble beyond what had once been the edge of the square. There were no more streets to follow, only an undulating wasteland of wreckage, spars and twisted girders jutting through mounds of broken masonry. The thousands of hablocks, refineries and manufactoria south of the basilica reduced to complete ruination. The dust still hung heavy in the night air, so that he had only his armor's inbuilt compass and the blinking burst map to navigate by. It was slow, hard going. He came across more survivors as he went, mostly rear echelon guard units.
"Help us, my lord,"
one man pleaded, stumbling from the darkness, cradling a broken arm. Others bore injured comrades, crying out for the Space Marine's aid or for orders amidst the confusion. He stopped for none. He had no instructions for them, and no time to help them tend injured friends or dig others out from under the collapsed ruins. If he did pause, more would die when the orcs struck. After a while, his vox bead crackled back to life. Demeter had managed to re-establish the link to the rest of the demi-company, and his instructions went out to all squads, his voice as calm and level as ever.
"Field Marshal Kloss has ordered a complete withdrawal from Shebat. We will be facilitating that retreat. The dust cloud from the rock is still too thick to risk a full aerial extraction, so it will be on foot. All squads are to hold their current positions for 30 minutes, so that the guard can conduct a staggered, overlapping move eastwards, towards the ash wastes. There, they will seek to establish a new front line. All units confirm."
Polixis Blink acknowledged the fresh orders as he went. Even disregarding the fact that there were now thousands of greenskins on the eastern bank of the river, the devastation wreaked by the rock's impact had shattered Imperial command and control. Units were scattered, dazed and struggling to deal with thousands of casualties from the collapsed buildings. Some were cut off, others had simply vanished, buried by the sudden violent tremors that had shaken apart most of the city. From the reports trickling in on the other frequencies, it seemed as if the main combat forces stationed along the newly taken line of the Gorgon's east bank were largely intact, but spotters were reporting increased activity from across the polluted river
including what looked like crude barges and rafts. The Xenos on the western bank had clearly been preparing to cross en masse for some time, and now that reinforcements had arrived, they were seizing the opportunity. Combined with the assault expected from the rock itself, there was no practical means for the guard to resist for long, even with the Primaris at their side. Palixis paused to check his visor display beside a street lumen whose wrought iron post had somehow survived the demolition of everything around it. The nearest squad, Clastis, was a mile to the west, overlooking a stretch of the river docks. They weren't reporting any casualties. The second nearest, Squad Domitian, was. According to the Vox, brothers Ennio and Trejo had been buried by the roof of a collapsing manufactorum, and the rest of Domitian were still working to extract them. They were the most southern of the Primaris squads. When the greenskins from the rock first encountered Imperial forces, it would be Domitian's hellblasters.
"I am approaching from the northeast. Watch your targeting matrices," Palixis said over the Vox.
A few minutes later, he discerned shapes in the gloom ahead, the familiar bulk of Mark X power armor.
"Well met, Brother Apothecary,"
Sergeant Domitian called out as he approached. Like everyone else, the Ultramarine's proud blue armor was now a uniform gray, caked in the dust that had shrouded Shabbat. Four of Domitian's hellblasters, Brothers Gratian, Junarius, Lorenz, and Luco, were standing watch over the rubble that had once been a manufactorum side row, while three more, Marius, Otho, and Victus, worked to haul debris away from one of the numerous mounds that had formed where one of the refinery city's workhouses had once stood.
"Ennio and Trejo were still inside when the shockwave hit," Domitian said, "as were Gratian and Luco, but they were able to work themselves free." "You have contact with them both over the Vox?" Palixis asked. "Yes, I'll patch you through."
"Brother Apothecary,"
crackled Ennio's voice over the link. He sounded calm and unhurried, apparently untroubled by the fact that he was buried beneath tons of rubble.
"Can you describe your injuries to me, brother?" Palixis asked, assessing the remote Vitae readout as he spoke.
"Left arm shattered,"
Ennio said tersely.
"It is unresponsive."
"Both legs,"
Trejo added, the pain audible in his voice.
"You should leave me, brothers. I will only be an encumbrance." "Cease such foolish chatter," Palixis ordered, checking the rubble underfoot.
The armor of the two Primaris had clearly taken the worst of the collapse. Any unaugmented human would have been immediately crushed by the building's fall.
"We shall have you up soon, brothers," he added.
"We are to withdraw when they are recovered," Domitian said.
"So it seems. The guard are retreating eastwards."
Domitian didn't answer. After a pause, Palixis realized why. His genhanced hearing, further magnified by his power armor, had detected noises in the darkness, out beyond the small perimeter established by the squad. Bestial bellows and roars, and the pounding of iron-shod boots.
"Xenos,"
Domitian said.
"From the south,"
Brother Gratian added, plasma incinerator raised.
"We must hurry,"
Palixis said, unclamping his absolver bolt pistol.
"Prime incinerators,"
Domitian ordered, the words followed by a low whine and the blue glow of charged plasma, suffusing the dust-choked night. Otho, Marius, and Victus had redoubled their efforts to drag aside the rubble, working down towards the locator tags triggered by Ennio and Trejo.
"Are there no guard units nearby?"
Palixis asked, as the raucous sound of the approaching mob grew louder.
"None that survived,"
Domitian said, facing south into the night.
"We rescued about a dozen men, all injured. They're on their way to the rear."
There was a thudding burst of bolter fire, muffled and distorted by the dust. Palixis half-turned, checking the designator on his display. The squads further along the Gorgon, including the nearest, Clastis, had begun to engage the greenskins that were attempting to cross the river. Any hope of support was rapidly evaporating.
"Fire at will,"
Domitian ordered.
The bellowing from the darkness had reached fever pitch, seeming to resound from all quarters, filling the night with the chilling promise of bloodshed. Polixis felt his twin hearts rising to the tempo of the approaching battle, and realized a snarl of adrenaline-fueled anticipation was splitting his lips. In that moment, he understood once again where Castor's burning passion for the thunder of war came from. A shout went up from Victus. Polixis saw he was dragging battered, grime-encrusted plate armor from the rubble at his feet. The Tabran campaign markings were visible around the gorget. It was Ennio. Polixis started towards him. At the same time, hunchback shapes came lumbering from the dust-swathed night, their roars filling the darkness.
"Open fire!" roared Domitian.
Chapter 3. Evacuation. Demeter. Captain Demeter and Ancient Skyrus were joined by Chaplain Castor as they departed from the Basilica. Field Marshal Kloss and his staff were packing away equipment they had set up mere hours before, burning what couldn't be taken in promethium drums in the remains of the square outside. Preparing to evacuate, one of the Marshal's aides had recommended blowing the munitions stockpiled just that evening in the crypts beneath the Basilica, but Kloss had denied the request, mindful of the propaganda defeat that would be inflicted on Imperial forces if they were seen to demolish one of the only buildings still standing in Shabbat, and an ancient place of worship at that. Demeter had done what he could to assist the Imperial Guard's withdrawal. Amidst the disastrous fallout, the captain had noted that a small piece of good fortune could yet prove decisive. Adhering to the orders to reinforce the capital of Croton in expectation of the Rock's landing there, two of Kloss's eight corps had already been on the move and were largely clear of Shabbat when the meteor had struck. They were now busy preparing a new defensive line on the edge of the ash wastes to Shabbat's east, just beyond the remains of the slum outskirts. If Kloss could extract even a few more corps, Demeter believed there would be sufficient numbers to pin the greenskins in the city until further reinforcements could be brought up. Saving just a few divisions, however, looked like it would be a tall enough order, let alone several corps. Communications were still choppy, and the wasteland the city had been reduced to was combining with the night and the dust to confound attempts at an orderly withdrawal. What was worse, the Xenos were now attacking along the length of the Gorgon in concert with those pouring from the rock. All contact with the southernmost guard brigades had long been lost, and Demeter began receiving reports from his southernmost Primaris, Squad Domitian, that they were coming under sustained assault. All along the line, the Primaris were holding on while they could, giving the Astra Militarum the precious minutes they needed to disengage. Demeter's gut told him they'd need more time. "Bring up Extremis," he ordered Tech Marine Tiberon over the Vox, "and Squad Tiro. We are taking the fight to the Xenos."
"We are to counterattack,"
Castor asked as they passed down the Basilica steps and into the square beyond.
"The Xenos must be focused," Demeter said. "They will be drawn to the area of most resistance. I will provide that resistance." "The rest of the Demi Company," Castor began. "Lieutenant Tyranus will take command," Demeter said. "His orders are to continue the extraction and support the Astra Militarum for as long as possible."
"Allow me to accompany you, Captain," Castor said. "Together we shall stem the tide of alien filth long enough to bring righteous fire back to this city."
"No, Castor," Demeter said. "The Company will need your presence and inspiration now more than ever. You are to link with Tyranus and provide leadership for both the Fulminata and the Guard."
"Captain Demeter," Castor said, coming up short. Demeter stopped with him. "We cannot lose you," the chaplain said. "The Company needs your leadership. The Guard needs it. Any one of us would die at your side beneath the banner of the Fulminata. Its sacred folds cannot be allowed to fall into the hands of Xenos savages."
"None of us will leave this city if a stand is not made,"